and welcome to the Listen Up Podcast. I'm Amanda Horvath. On this episode, we're talking about religion in the Midwest and how some in the Heartland are addressing misconceptions about their religion. But before we go into that, be sure to check out urban-plains.com for the latest stories. And now it's time to listen up. Think for a moment about where you get your beliefs and morals, from family, from community, and for many, from faith. In some ways, the Midwest is becoming the model for religious understanding. Bruce Espy grew up on a farm in Iowa as a Protestant.
It's what I grew up with, is what I knew, and I was kind of raised that the importance of a spiritual life. And then after 2 years of college, I went into the Army, and I did a tour of duty in Vietnam. You can imagine, for a kind of a rural, I grew up in a little farming town 60 miles north of here, not very worldly, to say the least. That kind of shook up my ideas, and I was actually able to do some reading when I was in the Army and just started exploring more.
In his quest for answers, Espy discovered Buddhism. He expected to find a life of peace.
Zen practice is for me, an experiential religion. In other words, we sit down, meditation is an important part, aspect of our practice, and it's kind of sitting down and facing who we really are.
For 17 years, Espy has been an ordained Buddhist priest, or monk. Quick explanation here. He says priest and monk are synonymous, but usually the names are used in reference to the location. In a monastery, he's a monk, and in a Zen center, he's a priest. Anyway, he tells us how Buddhism is different from other religions.
It's not a faith-based religion. There's an element of faith in it. I have faith in the practice, but it's really about really paying attention and waking up to, again, who you really are. So your practice is where you find yourself, what's under your feet, where you are right now. Everything changes. That's a tenet of Buddhism. Everything changes.
In the first part of this series, Espy told us about some of the misconceptions people have of him. He said they expect monks to always be calm and have reached a higher level state of being. But he says that's not the case.
People think that Buddhists don't get angry. Well, that's, you know, I don't beat people up, but I feel it. It comes, you know, these things come up, emotions come up. There's no point of arrival in Buddhism where you kind of stay there, that you somehow, people think that they're going to reach this enlightened state where suddenly everything's going to become clear and there's nothing's going to bother you and you're going to be peaceful all the time. And that's not our practice.
Another misunderstanding is Buddhists worship gods or deities, but they don't.
And we have different iconic statues and a couple of other statues in our Buddha hall and monasteries. There'll be different but kind of deities around, and they think that they are kind of somehow gods, but they're not. And we're not a theistic religion. We don't have a god in Buddhism.
In order to address these misconceptions, Espy started to offer his insight to those who wanted it.
In 2011, we started having introduction classes. Prior to that, I used to get calls almost weekly from people. They'd say, I want to talk about Buddhism, you know, so I'd set up appointments with people and, well, I'd meet them where they felt comfortable. And my unscientific survey showed that about 20% of the time, people didn't show up. I didn't hold that against anybody. I felt like they didn't know what to expect. They don't know what a Buddhist monk is like or a Buddhist priest is like, and they're going to come and sit across the table, and there's certain uncomfortableness with that, and they would just kind of think, I'm not ready for it. So we started having an introduction class. I said, let's do an intro class, so because people feel comfortable, it's more of it fits our culture when people go to class. They go to class and sit, and you don't have to answer, you don't have to ask anything. You sit there anonymously and just listen and don't have to engage if you don't want to. That's been really successful. We now have about probably between 200 and 300 people a year that come through for that.
While he holds these classes to help people find answers, Espy tells us people don't always find what they're looking for.
So when people come to Buddhism, Zen practice, and then they practice for a few months, and they go, oh, I don't feel that much better. We tend to have a turnover. No Zen groups are really that big because people kind of come and check it out, and that's okay. We don't proselyze. We don't recruit people. People come and go, and they're free to do that.
He even encourages people of other religions to try out his practice.
We have people in Jewish faith, Catholics who do our practice. So it doesn't have to be, people don't have to come here and even call themselves a Buddhist if they don't want to. I don't care.
SB has a fluid relationship with his religion, but there's one thing he teaches that he hopes others pick up.
So when Christians come to me now interested in Buddhism, I said, if you're really a Christian, then just go with it. You know, take it deep. Really, really go for it. You know, I'd tell them, what would Jesus do is something I could teach here. What would Jesus do? That's a good question. Approach that. How did Jesus approach his life? How did Jesus approach other people, his behavior to other people? So you don't have to be a Buddhist. I don't care if they're Buddhists or not. I care about how you engage your life.
With me now is Urban Plains senior editor Marissa Daly. Marissa found SB and conducted the interview for us.
So to start, how did you find Bruce?
Well, last year I was in a class where we were supposed to connect with members of the community that we didn't know. So we decided to, my group focused on Buddhists, and so we found the Zen Center, which is really close to Drake. So we went and talked to Bruce and kind of got in touch more with what Buddhism is really like and tried to figure out how it's different from misconceptions that we might have.
And so this time we sat down with him for a long time. So what did you learn from that interview with him?
I think the biggest thing that stuck with me was his acceptance of other religions. I think a lot of times we think of people as being very one-minded or thinking that they found the truth and nothing else is valid. And even though he's dedicated his entire life to Buddhism and he spends so much time thinking about it, and he's on a trip to Japan in the next couple of months, I think he'll be gone doing additional training, but he doesn't have any hatred or contempt for other religions. And part of what he said was basically, if this works for you and it helps you feel fulfilled in your life, then you should keep doing it. You don't even have to convert to Buddhism. And I thought that was really interesting and just very eye-opening to how accepting religion can be.
Right. He was saying that you can keep your own religion and still be in a Buddhist light.
Yeah, I think it was really surprising to me when he said that he has people come to him who are Christians, for example, and who are searching for something else. He encourages them to do deeper thinking and to maybe engage in their personal faith, like in their religion, on a more personal or deeper level. It seems like he just doesn't jump to the conclusion that Buddhism is one size fits all and works for everybody, which is really refreshing.
And have you ever met a Buddhist monk before? Was this your first time?
I think I'd encountered Buddhist monks. I think some visited Drake maybe last year. But the difference with Bruce is that he's from Iowa. I mean, he's not from Tibet, and he just doesn't fulfill the stereotypes that we imagine or that we associate with Buddhist monks in general.
But Bruce has this demeanor about him in the interview. He's very calm. How did you react to the way that Bruce preaches his religion?
I think he has a very calming presence, and he was just very much kind of demonstrating his faith just in the way that he interacted with other people or the way that he carried himself. He had that aura of calm, and I think that it was a very interesting way of like portraying his faith without even necessarily having to talk about it. He's just a different kind of person, and I think that has a lot to do with his faith.
So you grew up in a different country. What religion surrounded you there?
Well, I grew up in France, so I grew up Christian. I still consider myself Christian. I go to church frequently. I grew up with a lot of religious diversity, actually, because France has a huge Muslim population, which allowed me to just gain different perspectives. One of my best friends in high school was Muslim, and I think that's a really cool thing to be able to look back on as something that wasn't divisive. It's just like any other controversy, like race. Religion is something that people think makes it so that you can't get along with other people, and I don't think that's true. So I would say that's one of the biggest takeaways that I've taken from my education and the way that I grew up.
It sounds like to me that you seem like the perfect forefront for this story.
You also ended up finding Asma Asaruddin, who is a professor at Indiana University.
Yeah, so I just came across her as I was doing research for future stories for Urban Plains, and I found out that she'd written a book on, I think, trying to figure out, a better way to portray Islam and counteract this idea that, with things like ISIS being all over the news right now, there's this idea that anyone who follows that religion is like that, and I just think that it's really interesting that she is countering that movement, and her book was also given an award in Iran, which I thought was just a really interesting fact, so I thought that she would be worth talking to.
Well, thank you, Marissa, for your insight. Asma Afsaruddin is a professor of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at Indiana University. She was born in Bangladesh, but raised on the East Coast. She got her undergraduate degree from Oberlin College, where she started taking classes about the Middle East, Arabic languages, and Islam. She got her PhD from Johns Hopkins University, then taught at Harvard, the University of Notre Dame, and now at the University of Indiana. We talked to her because she has made her way around the world giving lectures and publishing books about Islam. She's opening the conversation about the misconceptions for this religion.
This has become very important, particularly after 9/11. As you might imagine, people are more aware now of Islam as a religion, as a global religion, and about Muslims in general, both within the United States, because, you know, many of us have, of course, Muslim neighbors and co-workers and teachers and so forth. And the media, of course, provides a lot of publicity for events related to Muslims, the Middle East and the Arab world in particular. My approach, both within the classroom and outside, when I'm called to give public lectures, hold workshops and so forth, my approach is to provide a larger view of things, you know, a more historical view of things. So I will start often with the very beginnings of Islamic history, from the 7th century of the Common Era down to our present time. And I highlight the diversity within the broad Islamic tradition, that Islam is not a frozen essence, and Muslims are active agents in their lives and have been so throughout history. So much of this history is very complex, and it is not reducible to any single stereotype. We cannot describe Muslims as just, you know, with just common adjectives. Muslims live very different lives depending on where they're located. The life of an American Muslim would differ considerably from the life of a Somali Muslim or a Muslim in China, for example. So we have to be aware of these complexities in people's lives and the huge diversity that exists within Islamic thought and within the larger Islamic tradition and cultural practice.
To fight stereotypes, Afsaruddin says education is key.
My position is that, you know, providing historically accurate information and information that can be grounded in the sources is probably the most effective way of undermining, you know, basic ignorance about Islam and Muslims that does exist in this country, both sometimes within academia and outside academia. So it's not as if, you know, I specifically set about challenging stereotypes, but that's part of my predominant mission. It's not. But what I see as coming out of my scholarship and my efforts to disseminate information about Islam and Muslims in a more scholarly manner, that, you know, one of the end results of that would be to challenge some of the existing stereotypes and replace that with more nuanced and complex ideas about Islam and Muslims.
Afsaruddin says people are generally receptive to her lectures and information.
For the most part, I will often get comments from my audience that, you know, they're actually hungry for more historically based and more complex and nuanced answers to their questions, and they're frustrated by the way the media often will tend to reduce these very complex ideas, concepts, and circumstances into simple stereotypes. So I often do get questions and comments of that sort from my audience. So for the most part, people tend to be receptive to the kind of lectures I tend to give. There are some who will resist, who will want to insist that there is something fundamentally wrong with Muslims, that they're essentially violent and incapable of coexisting peacefully with other groups of people. I hope that, you know, when I present my perspectives and ground them again in historically reliable sources, that it makes them rethink some of these positions and maybe encourage them to do a little bit more research on their part.
A main thing that Afsaruddin says we should keep in mind with Islam is that it's different based on the culture surrounding it.
Cultural practices within Muslim-majority societies can be quite different, can be quite divergent. But I think this internal diversity is the strength of Muslim societies today. But that's often lost in, you know, in media representations of Muslim countries and the lives of Muslims in the world.
Another stereotype of Islam Afsaruddin addresses is violent actions.
War is a highly restricted activity within the Islamic legal system. According to the Quran, you know, the foundational text, of course, within Islam, war can only be defensive. It can only be in response to a prior attack by a hostile enemy. Now, different jurists have had different positions on this matter, but ultimately, when we go back to the foundational text within Islam, peace is the preferable option over war at any given time. Now, whether Muslims have always observed that in their own lives and in their own interactions with other people, of course, you know, that answer has to be very, very complex, because again, we have to take into consideration the historical context and so forth.
Afsaruddin says the way media represents Islam contributes to the misunderstandings of the religion.
What's unfortunate is a lot of these positive things are happening below the radar. The people don't often have a sense of the, you know, these transformative experiences that are occurring even in the heartlands. We tend to often focus more on the sensational stuff and the more depressing stuff.
So then we asked her, how can the media improve coverage of Islam?
Need to have access to better information. I think that's part of the problem. They often don't know where to turn, and oftentimes they're writing under the gun. In other words, they have to produce these pieces, you know, their essays in a very short period of time, and so they have to sacrifice nuance and complexity and write in these sound bites, you know, that are easily understandable to a larger group of people. I think we should be conscious of our responsibility towards the media, that, you know, we can make a difference in their perception. So I try not to turn down a request for an interview with the media or, you know, to give public talks where journalists will be present, because I think those are important occasions for us to talk to them and start a conversation about some of these issues and get them to understand the various aspects to an issue and not just reduce them to kind of a monolithic idea. So I think this can be a productive conversation. It's just that there aren't too many opportunities of that sort, and I wish there was an easier way of creating these opportunities for us to talk to the media and for them also to have a conversation with us.
Starting the conversation, a conversation to better understand religions or cultures different from our own, is the way Afsaruddin thinks we can begin to solve these misconceptions. In the end, that's what we hope to do. That's what these Midwesterners hope to do. Begin the conversation that sparks religious understanding. To find more conversation-starting stories, visit urban-plains.com. You can also like our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter for the latest updates and behind-the-scenes looks into our Urban Plains staff. Special thanks to Bruce Espy and Asma Afsaruddin, Senior Editor Marissa Daly, Editors Grace Wenzel, Mario Rossi, Kaylee Kunkel, and Annalise Turnowski. I'm Amanda Horvath. This has been Listen Up.